Good morning. Thank you for getting up early and getting here at 9. My name is David Soybert. I'm the chair of this morning's session on archives, with the added addition of Chris Lesinick's paper on digital interstitial errors. So in the inevitable shuffle, when all of you archives types leave after the third paper, please be mindful and not to bump into all the people coming in from the other session in between that break. So thank you for coming this morning. The first paper we're going to hear is by Frank Furco of Stanford University's Archive of Recorded Sound. And I'm especially interested in hearing this paper today because when I was an intern at Stanford's Archive of Recorded Sound back in 1997, I was unpacking boxes of tapes from the Ambassador Collection. So I'm interested in hearing what you guys have all discovered in that wonderful collection. But Frank currently holds the position of sound cataloger and project archivist in the Archive of Recorded Sound at Stanford University. Since December 2009, he has been project archivist for an archival processing project sponsored by the Council on Library and Information Resources. The current project focuses on arranging and describing four specific collections comprised primarily of sound recordings, and the Ambassador Auditorium Collection is the largest of the four collections. For 3 years prior to that, he has produced original cataloging for several thousand 78 RPM sound recordings in a collaborative project with Yale University, New York Public Library, and Syracuse University, and that was funded by the Mellon Foundation, and I know those catalog records well, so we use them. Prior to his work at Stanford, Frank worked for 26 years at the Northwestern University Library, first in the Administrative Services Department, and then for 23 years as a music cataloger at Northwestern's Music Library. From 2001, that can't be right. Your professional career has already been 49 years long.
Oh, I'm over 100.
So. Okay. From 2001 to 2005, he cataloged manuscript materials and created finding aids for collections in Northwestern's Music Manuscript Project. In addition to his career as a cataloging librarian and archivist, Frank also maintains a parallel career as a professional composer working under an exclusive publishing contract with E.C. Shermer Music. His music has been heard either live or in radio broadcasts in 30 countries and 6 continents. So please welcome Frank Furco.
Thank you. This morning I'm going to focus on a very specific portion of the Ambassador Auditorium Collection. As we go through this, I'm going to take you on a little tour of the Ambassador. It's in Pasadena, which is not far from here, and some of you may have been there, or at least you know of the place. But many of you may not, and so I'm going to take you on just a little tour here of the Ambassador so you get an idea of what the place was all about. And I may drift in and out of this microphone because I'm doing things over here. Let's see if I can just do it that way. There we go. So here's the quick tour. This is an aerial view of the Ambassador, and it is right there. It looks like an old temple, and it was actually modeled to look like the ancient Temple of Israel. It was built by Herbert W. Armstrong of the Worldwide Church of God. It was originally meant to be a place of worship for the Worldwide Church of God, as well as a place for concerts that would attract people of international renown, and indeed that's what occurred there. The place opened officially for concerts on April 7th, 1974. And it continued to operate on a full schedule for about 20 years and finally ran out of money, basically, and went out of business at the end of May of 1995. So it was basically a 20-year period that the Ambassador operated. During that 20-year period, it was, in fact, one of the prime concert halls on the West Coast. So they made an effort to attract as many different kinds of performers from many different genres and areas, not just classical, although they focused on classical, but they also brought in dance companies and comedy acts, and they had television specials and all kinds of things there. So it was a very active place. The archive that we're processing is actually the entire archive, all of the files from the Ambassador, the office files, the little notes that the house staff scribbled on programs at the ends of performance. I mean, all kinds of things. Personal issues, the hotel requirements of Maria Callas, who was supposed to perform there and eventually canceled and never did. But all this documentation is in there about her requirements for when she came there, and so on with other performers. These are more photographs of the ambassador. No expense was spared when they built this place. So they had hand-woven carpets from India and gold inlay and Iranian onyx and African teak wood and all sorts of imported very fine materials to build this hall. It was supposed to be the prime place on the west coast of America. These are some shots of the lobby. The large chandelier had over 1,800 pieces of baccarat crystal. Another shot of the chandelier, and then this is the concert hall. The hall was dubbed the Carnegie Hall of the West, not because it looked or acted like Carnegie Hall, except that it attracted the same caliber of performers as Carnegie Hall. The seating capacity of the ambassador was 1,262, and the seating capacity of the Isaac Stern Auditorium in Carnegie Hall is 2,804. So that hall is more than twice the size of the Ambassador Hall. But the Ambassador Hall had fantastic acoustics, and because of its small size, it was a perfect venue for chamber groups and solo recitals, and so that's what they focused on to a large degree. This is a shot of the hall itself, and in the center of the balcony, let's see if I can get a cursor going here, yeah. Is that showing up right here in the center of the balcony? There was a recording booth. They had multiple recording booths in the place, but they had one that was right in the middle of the seating of the balcony. This is the photo on the left is that booth that you just saw up in the seating, and the other on the right side is one of the other booths. The place was equipped with state-of-the-art equipment. They had 11 Ampex recording machines, as well as some other recorders. They were wired for video and also connected to a commercial television station. So they were able to record audio and video anywhere in the hall, even backstage. So they were pretty sophisticated in their work. Here are a couple more shots, booth shots. At this point in the collection, these are statistics of what we have processed. So there are audio tapes and videotapes. In many cases, performances were, both kinds of recording were made of a performance, so there would be an audio tape and a video of it. But they just made in-house recordings of these live performances and kept them in their own files. They also sent some of the tapes out to local radio stations for broadcast, and that they did on a regular basis. They also, from time to time, record producers would come in and use the tapes from the ambassador to release a commercial live recording of one of their own artists. So if an artist was under contract with Angel Records, Angel would come in and ask that the recording be made specifically for a future release. These are just a few of the many, many, many people who performed there. I tried to put together a list that focused a bit on classical, since there were so many classical artists there, but there are also a few others, as you see on the column on the left, down a little bit. There are people like Anna Russell and Victor Borga, who were not really classical people, but they certainly were classically trained, Clancy Brothers, and so on. On the other column, the Romeros and the Odessa Balalaikas, and there were many folk dance ensembles and other groups like that, as well as the classical performers. And recordings of these people are in the archive. One of the reasons that I consider this to be so important is that even though many of these people recorded commercially, the performances they did at the Ambassador were unique performances, and things would occur in these live performances that you may never hear in a commercial recording. For example, a performer would take a risk and decide, tonight I'm going to do it this way, and they would do some amazing thing that they would do only one time, and there it is on tape. Other times there were mistakes that were made, and so it sort of gives us a clue that these people are human just like the rest of us. And sometimes they would get very informal and talk to the audience, and that's something you don't get on a commercial recording. So it's really interesting to have these kinds of house recordings in a collection to refer to. Some of the other performers that were there, I'm going to run through a whole list here of various people, but we have jazz performers Count Basie and George Shearing. Ravi Shankar and Yo-Yo Ma. Ravi Shankar performed there in 1983, and Yo-Yo Ma was there many times. We have recordings from 1980 and 1981. Joan Sutherland, Leontine Price. These are all signed photographs, too, by the way. There were the files and files of autographed photos that are in this collection, so it was kind of fun to look at all of those. One of the commercial recordings that was made was from a performance of Arthur Rubinstein in January of 1975. He played a concert that was titled The Last Recital for Israel. And this was a recording that many years later, around 1990, RCA Victor decided to release it, both the audio and the video. So the video was released on a video cassette. I have a little bit of a recording here. Since I'm limited on time, I'm not going to play everything, but just to let you know, he was 88 years old when he played this concert. And he played a full concert, ended it with Chopin's A-flat major Polonaise. And although there are lots of wrong notes in it, it is amazing to hear the quality of his performance at that age. So it's really interesting to listen to some of these recordings and performances. Christopher Parkening was a frequent performer at the Ambassador. He did not, they did not make any commercial recordings or any in-house recordings of him, but they did at one point make a video when he performed a duo guitar concert with David Brandon. So the video recording is in the collection. Andre Watts is the other photograph. He performed there also many times. And there are numerous recordings of him in the collection. Ivo Pogorelich was sort of a hot young rising star in the mid-80s, and he performed there a few times in 1987. Then later, he and his wife and the Ambassador Foundation decided that they were going to start an international Ivo Pogorelich solo piano competition that would occur every 3 years. And so the first one was scheduled to occur in December of 1993. And they invited pianists from all over the world to participate. So what they did, though, at the Ambassador was record all of these performers. So when they came in to play their concert as part of their competition entry, the performances were recorded on audio. And the final round that had the six finalists, those performances were videotaped. So we have those in the collection as well. The competition occurred in December of 1993, and the next one was supposed to happen 3 years later, but 3 years later was 1996, and the Ambassador had already closed. So this particular competition was the only one that ever occurred, and the collection includes huge amounts of material from this, because they really went all out, including these wonderful sort of gold, it's not real gold, but gold-looking statuettes that were given out as awards at the end of the competition. And all sorts of really neat paraphernalia that is there. I am going to play a little clip here of Ivo Pogorelich talking. He was very much liked by the Ambassador people, and so he was around quite a bit. When he did appear there, he also did interviews, and that's another aspect of this collection, is it's not just musical performances, but it's also interviews. And so we have, I have a little clip here that I will play. Ivo Pogorelich, even though he was a very high-class kind of classical performer, had his own tastes, and one of his favorite pianists was Oscar Peterson. And so in this interview, he talks about that.
And I hear that Oscar Peterson is one of your favorites. Is that true?
Well, yes, he is definitely. I think he's one of the most gifted musicians of in the field of performing arts this century. Certainly a wonderfully inspired musician. I surprised many when I was asked, I think it was in Italy.
Also, Billy Taylor and his trio performed there. in May of 1991. I have a little clip of both an interview and a little bit of the performance. So first, the interview.
Very crisp playing. Is that something that's a real aim of yours? I always notice it in your work.
Yeah, well, that's the way I play. Many years ago, I guess, playing with Charlie Parker and some of the musicians at Birdland, you come to the idea that it is up to you to come up with your own thing. I mean, and I didn't want to sound like Bud Powell or Art Tatum or any of the people that were also playing there. And this really is the way I sound. It really is reflective of how I think musically.
Another feature of the Ambassador was that they hosted the Pasadena Jazz Festival from 1992 to 1995, and they probably would have hosted it longer than that, except that they went out of business. But as we see in the slide, there were they didn't stop or hold back from issuing the coffee mugs and T-shirts and all that business, but the logo was just kind of a fun logo. I liked it, so I thought I would include that here. Just to give you a general idea of what some of the stuff looks like when it comes to the Stanford Archive, these are some of the carts of real open reel tapes that came through last summer when we were processing them. These are some of the 1984-85 concert tapes. The carts that you see all have three shelves on them, so what you see on the top level is just one third of the cart. There are two more shelves beneath, and then the cart that's in front behind that are more. So it gives you an idea of the number of tapes just from a single concert season. Most of the tapes were in very good shape, and they stay in very good shape. They're kept in an environmentally controlled facility that's off-site in the East Bay. And so temperature and humidity and all of that are controlled. These recordings are recent enough that they haven't really started to degenerate to any major degree. We've noticed a few small problems that we were able to take care of, like there had been some water leakage at one point somewhere along the line, and a little bit of mold had developed, but our preservation department took care of that, so those tapes are fine. What you see in the photo here is basically the kind of condition that most of the tapes are in, so they are in really good shape. Some of the really early tapes came to us as pancakes, and they had become all disheveled, and we had to have somebody sit there by hand and put them all onto a reel and get those in order, but it worked. It took a while, but thank God for students. Then tapes came to us, and there are cassettes and DATs, and they come in, you know, all mixed up together. And what we have to do, let's see if I can. There it is. I have to put these things in some kind of order, and so we did that and got them into nice archival boxes so they look nice and pretty. And then we put them on a shelf like that, and we put labels on them and barcodes, and we send them back out to the offsite storage facility. There is so much material in this archive. The storage facility is really the only place where it can exist all at one time. There's no other space that we have that will accommodate the whole thing at one time. The videos come to us in different ways. There were large video reels and also VHS cassettes, beta cassettes, and U-matic tapes. So there's a little bit of everything. There were also a few films that came through, 16 millimeter and 35 millimeter. They tried all kinds of things. These are some of the video tape reels. In the picture on the right, there are four reels. One of them is from a performance of Benny Goodman, and the two on the far right are from a concert performance of the Vienna Symphony Orchestra that was in December of 1974. They did television specials, as I mentioned before. There was a Bob Hope television special broadcast from the stage of the Ambassador. We do not have the recording of that, but it did include, we have a lot of printed material. It included Bob Hope along with Carol Burnett, Patti Page, Ben Vereen, Steve Allen, and Dinah Shore. And the other photograph is from a TV special that was hosted by Pearl Bailey, and her guests were Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. We do not have that recording, but we do have a recording of Pearl Bailey giving a talk to the audience at a different time. So she appeared there on numerous occasions. And then some of the dance companies that were there, the National Ballet of Canada, the Dance Theater of Harlem performed there numerous times. And then I just got some sort of collage shots of some of the brochures and photos of promotional photos of some of the people who perform there. And for most of these people, we have the recordings. So if you recognize some of those faces, James Galway and the Modern Jazz Quartet, Jesse Norman, and a few other people. Also here, Leontine Price, Debbie Reynolds. There's a pink poster with a champagne glass. That was the stars of the Lawrence Welk show. They performed there, and we have the recording of that. And a few more. They also did full productions, full stage productions of musical theater. So the top photograph in this shot is HMS Pinafore. They did a whole range, a whole series of Gilbert and Sullivan performances, and we have those in the recordings. Also, Big River was on tour from Broadway. We do not have that recording, but they did perform there. And then the other poster there is Herod and the Innocents. It was an early music drama. So that is there. Carol Burnett and, or not Carol Burnett, Carol Channing and Rita Moreno did a show together. And I'm sorry that we don't have the recording of that, but I put this in here just to let you see that there were Broadway performers who came and performed there. And some of them did get recorded, and the recordings are in the collection. But this one in particular just sort of grabbed my attention, so I put it there. Primarily, they were known for... even though they had many different kinds of performers there, the Ambassador was known for classical musicians, and I have this one little clip that I will play. This is from a live performance of Jesse Norman and Joseph Vila on March 3rd, 1985. In this slide, I just wanted to show you the four collections that are being processed under the CLEAR project. The Yehudi Menuhin collection is already finished. The Finding Aid is on the Online Archive of California. The Lawrence Tibbett collection also is finished, and that's the Finding Aid is on OAC. Next is the Yasha Heifetz collection. which is also finished, and the Finding Aid is up. So the only one that we're still working on is the last one on this list, the Ambassador Collection. The Finding Aid should be available on the Online Archive of California at about August 1st. The project will continue to be through July, basically, and we've been working on the Finding Aid as we've been processing everything. So it should be ready to go and ready to mount August 1st. And these are my credits, people in the Archive of Recorded Sound. If you need to contact any of us, please feel free to do so. And that's my presentation. Questions?
First, were the cassettes run as backups or were they run as primaries?
So far as we know, they were run as backups. Although we can't really tell completely because in many cases the cassettes that we have are the only copies that we have. In many cases they are duplicates of the open reel tapes, and so we just assumed that the open reel tapes were the main ones. But my impression is that some of the tapes went out like to radio stations and never came back, or something happened to them because we don't have them. So that's all I know about those.
One more question.
Oh, okay.
Do we have anybody with a question about access?
Yeah.
Let's hear an access question, and then we'll move on to Kim's talk, and
you can
catch up with Frank after the presentation.
Yes.
Of
what about access?
Yeah, is it open to the, I mean, is it, can it be used by the public?
It can be used by the public. None of it is digitized. That was not part of this project, but the material is available. So if what you need to do, if you want to come and hear any of it, is make an appointment with Aurora Perez, who is on that list. She's the operations manager. Contact her and set up an appointment. The access to the archive is by appointment only. And so if you make an appointment with her, you can come in and listen to things. Because these materials are stored off-site, you have to allow a couple of days for the trucks to bring things over. So there's a little bit of a time lag there, but yes, things are. I don't think so. There's no charge to listen to things, no.
Thank you very much.
I don't know where this came from, so your audio man will have to deal with that. I don't know where the audio came from on there. Okay. Thank you, Frank. And if there's, I know there's more questions about the Ambassador Collection, and if we have time at the end, I think the panelists would probably be willing to address further questions on from any of the papers. So thank you for that.